Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this seminar on collaboration with the private sector in the Swedish Development Corporation. And we will start off this day with a presentation and discussion of a most recent study commissioned by the expert group of eight studies, and I will soon introduce the author of this study. But let me give you some background. What is the expert group on aid studies? Well, it's an independent committee under the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Sweden. It was inaugurated some 2 years and a half ago, and we do produce a number of reports. And this current one is the number 6 of 2015. From 2013, there have been a number of reports on different issues related to, well, basis and the Swedish Development Corporation, because the aim of this committee is to evaluate and analyze the Swedish Development Corporation, I would say, in a broader context, looking into the global development at large. And we are very happy to have a study now on what is labeled the joint development initiatives. It's not pure a private-public partnership, and that Ari will tell us more a bit about. But how does the Swedish Development Corporation cooperate, good partner with private entities in driving development in developing countries? The committee is as I mentioned, an independent committee. It's chaired by Lars Heikensten, who is CEO of the Nobel Foundation, and we are 10 members in the committee, meeting more or less every 6 weeks or 6-7 times a year to decide on studies to undertake, decide on studies to publish, but also run seminars like this. So I guess, well, all studies that we do produce are also presented in a seminar like this, but we also have other seminars during the year. So look into our website and you will find what is going on, not only study-wise, but also seminars on other topics. Having said that, I would like now to introduce the authors of this study, which is Ari Kokko and his team. And Ari is a professor at the Department of International Economics and Management at the Copenhagen School of Business Administration. And you have a background with Åbo, with Stockholm School of Economics, in a number of areas, and have published a lot of articles, journal articles, and also books on these topics. So we have a very well-experienced lead author. And your co-authors are Sara Johansson de Silva, who is nowadays an independent consultant with a background also in World Bank and OECD, and also dealing a lot with these issues. And also Hanna Nurborg, and you're with Lund University.
And I'm also an independent consultant.
Independent consultant, yeah. Okay. You have been maybe with the Lund? Yes. Yes. Okay, so it's abroad. It's from southern Sweden and also from different parts. And you also worked with OECD, WTO, IUCN, and others. So with those few words, let me invite Ari, and you will present the outcome and your findings of the study. Later on, I will invite a number of commentators, and then we will open up for a general discussion with all of you here in this hall. So please, Ari. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and good morning. The division of labor we have decided on is that I will present the findings and the summary of our study myself, and then my co-authors, Hannah and Sara, will take care of the difficult questions that will come later, so they will get more space in the panel debate. The background for thinking about partnerships between the private sector and the public sector, or perhaps more specifically the donors, is of course that the development landscape is changing quite radically. What we have seen is that the share of ODA in the total inflows of capital to developing countries has been reduced. Overall inflows are increasing, of course. But as you see here in these charts and in the report later on, we have, in particular in the lower middle income country section, a lot of remittances, a lot of foreign direct investments, and also traces of portfolio investments coming in, contributing resources to development. In the low income countries, of course, portfolio investment is not yet anything to count on. Foreign direct investment is still relatively small, although it accounts for 20% of capital inflows to these countries as well, remittances are important. So we have the same tendencies there. And if we go up, of course, the role of ODA is even, in income levels, the role of ODA is even smaller. And this introduces, of course, the question of, okay, how can these private initiatives that are becoming more important, how can they be leveraged in the development work? There are many good motives for trying to capture the resources and the assets we have in the private sector. One obvious reason is that sustainable development and poverty reduction is achieved mainly through job creation. We need to have production, we need to have jobs, we need to have the machinery working in order to move from situations of severe poverty to higher incomes and higher living standards. And jobs are created primarily through the private sector. We have the financial resources coming in, and they may contribute to the overall challenges related to development. We have a very innovative private sector where the last 10, 15 years have witnessed a very substantial discussion around base of the pyramid innovations, around the commercial motives for actually moving into these kinds of countries and generating interesting innovations, interesting findings, interesting new products and services. And then there is a potential for achieving very positive development effects through responsible business practices in foreign companies coming in and adapting or implementing the kinds of standards that they're used to implementing in their home countries. But it's also important to note that we have had a growing ambition in the business sector to take part in development over the past couple of decades. The growing concern for corporate citizenship and corporate responsibility paves the way for these kinds of partnerships. If the private sector had not been interested, if commercial profit had been the only motive behind their actions, it would have been substantially more difficult to try to achieve partnerships. So we do have an interesting potential for initiatives involving both the private sector and the public sector. Now, what is a joint development initiative, and why do we use this term? Well, there is, of course, a lot of discussions about public-private partnerships, but in the world where I come from, which is more an academic environment and more a business-oriented environment, PPPs are almost always linked to infrastructure projects. And I wanted to avoid that, or we wanted to avoid that focus on infrastructure. There's a lot written about infrastructure projects and the delivery of public services through the private sector. So we wanted to make a distinction and say that, okay, we're not mainly looking at infrastructure. We're looking at the regular activities of private enterprises and how these can be moved in a direction that promotes development. So a joint development initiative is a partnership for development between the private sector and the public sector, and in most cases a donor agency. And the private sector is an active participant, an active partner, contributing to development objectives, not primarily as a deliverer of goods and services, but through its regular operations in the developing countries. Two ways where this can occur: either direct business involvement or investment in areas that are important for development, or through the principles and practices that they use and implement that reflect higher levels of corporate responsibility and sustainable business than what perhaps is the standard in these countries. In the practical work that we've done, we've made a couple of other delimitations as well. We look at partnerships leveraged by CEDA and Sweat Fund. There are others that we haven't looked at, for instance, those that are managed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And there are others that are managed through other public sector agencies. Getting a really full overview of these is difficult. We do not discuss the pure charity work of the private sector either, and that could have a role in particular in some types of work. I will briefly mention it later, but we're not going to get into it. There are a few preconditions for these partnerships, for making them effective and functionable. And these preconditions we have set out from the perspective of the donor or from a development perspective. So it's development, not the commercial interests, that are the primary objectives of interventions and partnerships. That's really a central starting point. It's good if it has commercial value, but it should never be judged only on the commercial value. We look at donor contributions that create value added and not those that finance activities that would, for one reason or another, be carried out anyway. And this is sometimes important because most big companies and multinationals are under pressure to undertake a lot of corporate social responsibility-related activities. So sometimes we do have borderline cases. Partnerships should not obviously distort competition in the marketplace. It's one of many potential instruments. This is not going to be the general tool for creating development everywhere. It is suitable for addressing some problems but not others. And there is a need to manage risks. And this need comes from the fact that many of the mechanisms for these JDIs, joint development initiatives, are fairly new, and we really don't know how they play out over the medium term. But also because there is an inherent contradiction between the principles of aid and the objectives of development cooperation and the drivers of commercial operations. And we need to be aware of this tension in order to avoid problems. This potential is, of course, clearly recognized already in the Swedish aid policy framework, where these partnerships are discussed, and basically this summary takes up the concerns that I just mentioned, perhaps not as explicitly as I did, but it's there in any case. Now, our objectives with this report have basically been threefold. The first objective we have had is to look at the relevance of joint development initiatives in the light of the Swedish aid objectives. When we look at what we are trying to achieve in our development cooperation, how can we use these new instruments? Are they suitable for the various kinds of objectives that we have? Our second task has been to map the existing initiatives in Swedish development cooperation. And the third task has been to discuss how it is possible to mitigate the risks inherent in these kinds of partnerships. What can be done and what kinds of risks should we be particularly concerned about? It's important to note already here that we haven't tried to make any evaluations of the efficiency of this tool as a whole, or valuing or measuring or weighting the different kinds of instruments against each other. And the reason we haven't moved in that direction is that there is not a lot of data available. There are not a lot of evaluations, so we can't really do a meta evaluation of these. And this is related to the fact that several of the instruments and tools are relatively new. They haven't been in use for a very long time. Others have been there for a longer time, and in particular the kinds of investments carried out, for instance, by Sweat Fund. If we look at the Swedish development objectives, you all recognize these, everybody who works in the world of development cooperation will feel familiar with the targets of promoting human rights or various kinds of rights, of reducing poverty and improving inclusion, promoting environmental sustainability, health, resolving or avoiding conflicts, and assisting in humanitarian crisis. In theory, I guess we could position partnerships where private actors are involved somewhere in each of under each of these objectives. There is potential for doing something almost in every one of these. The problematic ones are, of course, these ones. The purely humanitarian interventions are perhaps those that would bring in the charity work of the private sector in the same way as a lot of our humanitarian, acute humanitarian interventions could be compared to charity work. We don't have the long-term, we can't afford putting in the long-term development objectives in those cases. Conflict resolution is also difficult. But for the others, I think that we can find examples and we can find good arguments in principle for why we should find scope and space for partnerships. So in terms of rights, in terms of poverty reduction and inclusion, environment and health, there is scope and potential. In Swedish development cooperation, these four objectives have been met with different kinds of instruments. And the kinds of instruments that we have, and this categorization of instruments that we're using, you know, that's not only our own, this is used in literature in general, includes innovative investments. These are investments with the potential to promote development and leverage private financial resources. These are the kinds of interventions that we carry out through various kinds of challenge funds, the health fund, a global fund related to the Gates Foundation. We have most of what Swedfund does in promoting private investments in developing countries. We have interventions that could be categorized under sustainable business programs, where the objective is to influence the way companies operate and how they impact on their environment, not only through their own actions, but also the actions of their partners. An example here could be the Child Rights for Business program and many of the things that the parties of the labor market are engaged in outside of Sweden, trade unions, for instance. And then we have partnerships or partnership initiatives for development aiming to create some sorts of public goods, whereas these two are fairly clear categories. This is a sort of more unclear or abstract category where we perhaps are best able to illustrate what we mean through examples. One example here could be the kinds of vocational training that some large firms are engaged in their host countries, where the training itself has some private benefits, but where there is also a public benefit because the programs involve more people than what the key companies themselves are going to employ, or because the people receiving this training have freedom to actually use their skills wherever they want in society, contributing also to other areas than the activities of the key firms. There's a deeper discussion about these kinds of examples of these kinds of interventions in Annex 2 in our report. So what do we see in Swedish development cooperation in the activities of Swedish firms? Well, it's important to put the small print first here because it really drives what we can say and what we can do. And that small print says that, firstly, there is no exhaustive list of these partnerships available, so we've had to patch together a picture. And as any puzzle that you draw from reality, there are going to be some pictures missing, so we can't claim to be fully exhaustive. And it's also difficult to find consistent and comparable data, which also weakens the precision of what we're doing. But it is possible to hint at a general picture anyway, and I don't think we are extremely far from the truth in this. What we can say is that JDIs are a growing but still modest share of Swedish development cooperation. It's there, but it is not a dominant part yet, and it's not likely to become a dominant part in the near future. If we look at what CEDA and Swedfund were doing last year, in terms of these kinds of partnerships, the programs covered approximately 2% of the total ODA budget for Sweden. So it's not big, perhaps a bit more than 2%. It's a little bit difficult to include the guarantees here, which really are part of innovative investments, because what is the value of a guarantee if it's never used? And many of the guarantees are never used. So that's a complication, but it's not big. They are focused on the eight objectives that I highlighted with my little red box earlier: rights, poverty reduction, environment, and health. We don't see any substantial Swedish partnerships or programs or joint development initiatives yet focusing on conflicts and humanitarian objectives. Innovative investments, various kinds of challenge funds, are the most common tools or instruments. If we look at where in the world we do things, global programs are overall the biggest, but if we try to distinguish a region, it would be Africa, in line with what we do in general. So these two characteristics here match pretty well what happens in the rest of Swedish development cooperation. Now, the risks and challenges, and this is where we spend most of our report, the risks and challenges are often related to the principles of effective aid. We have set up a set of rules that should guide us in our development cooperation in general, and of course these principles should also apply for the joint development initiatives. We shouldn't create entirely new standards for those practices that involve foreign enterprises. And here are a few of those. First and perhaps most important principle is targeting the most vulnerable. And already here we really see that there is a little bit of a clash with commercial logic. The most vulnerable groups are typically not great customers. They don't have a lot of purchasing power. It's therefore very difficult to target the purely commercial operations in such a way that they will involve the most vulnerable groups. Not even in the cases where we have employment creation at a large scale is it guaranteed that it is the most vulnerable people that will benefit from the job opportunities, because they are also often handicapped by lack of formal education and training, weak human capital in general for health reasons and other things. So here is a challenge. The exception perhaps is related to programs where we focus on rights and corporate social responsibility, where targeting can be stronger. Another principle is that we should leverage synergies and complementarities for development in our interventions. And there is clearly a clash here as well. We are talking about the need to bridge two cultures that are very different. On the one hand, we have a business culture where entrepreneurship, risk-taking, commercial objectives, speed, and also, to some extent, exclusiveness are very important keywords for what companies would like to focus on. The objectives related to development, represented through the operations of donor agencies, are are slightly different. And there is really a lot of work needed to try to close this gap. When we talk to companies, and you'll hear more about that when we get to the panel discussion, it is very common that companies complain about the administrative burdens that occur in every instance where an attempt is made to cooperate with the donor agencies or with the public sector. Instead of having very quick decision processes, things have to be prepared in a much more careful way. There are requests for all kinds of information and all kinds of reporting. It's a matter of developing markets, not disturbing markets. And there is, of course, a risk here of subsidization at two levels. On the one hand, we have the micro-level subsidization that could occur if an individual company moving into a developing market gets a lot of support, credits, guarantees, or whatnot, putting it in a stronger position commercially compared to other firms, and particularly severely, if that position puts them ahead of local firms that would be interested in operating in the same market. That's absolutely not desirable. But there is also macro subsidization that is related to tying of aid. And formally, of course, Sweden doesn't have tying of aid, but there is a need to be aware of the fact that almost everything that happens, almost all the participants in these partnerships from the Swedish side are Swedish firms. So this is a very national kind of program. It's hard to avoid, and especially it's hard to avoid in the early stages when new instruments are introduced, because you're looking for partners, and where are you looking? You're looking in your own backyard. But opening up and thinking about who the best partners potentially are in the future, I think is important. Another really big challenge is related to the objective of ensuring sustainability. We want local ownership, we want harmonization, we want coordination. And here we have this contradiction. A lot of the initiatives that we're hoping to see should come from the private sector. We shouldn't mandate the private sector to do something. It's really difficult for our partner countries to mandate the private sector to achieve certain things. So initiatives should come from the business sector. They should be active participants. And if the idea comes from the business sector, how can we then be sure that it is well rooted in the partner country, in the recipient country? Well, we can try to address these problems, and there are remedies. They are related to inclusiveness, having procedures that are open, disseminating results, formulating exit strategies at early stages, so that this is not an enclave that exists for a while and then disappears. And results orientation, measuring results and fostering systemic impact, another objective that needs active attention in terms of dissemination, replication, knowledge transfer. We have a few recommendations. When we communicated with Torgny, he said, if you're able to put your recommendations in terms of three questions, when, where, and how, it would be good. This was not our original way, but I think we can interpret some of these recommendations in terms of the questions when, where, and how. The first is when. Well, what we say is that many of these instruments are very new, and we don't know exactly how they're going to play out, and we don't really understand all of the challenges yet. So when we start rolling them out, perhaps it is good to continue the way it has started in a very gradual manner. That, I think, is important for the future as well. I don't think it would be a wise idea to quickly decide that these instruments should account for 20% of Swedish development partnerships or development cooperation, because that would open up a lot of unknown and uncharted territory. I think we have a particular focus, or we have had a particular focus in our own thinking, on the catalytic role of civil society organizations. Risks related to direct funding of activities done, commercial activities done by the private sector, are there. It's really difficult to find instances where you're actually not improving the relative competitiveness of the firm that is selected for partnerships. But if we pick civil society and encourage civil society to push their key issues related to rights, to environment, to health, or whatever, we know that they are not going to focus only on specific companies, but it's a much more broad and comprehensive approach that affects everybody. And where? Well, the initial contradiction that I mentioned, the fact that the most vulnerable groups are not the most attractive for commercial operators, I think is still going to be there for a long time. At the same time, middle-income or lower-middle-income countries, I think, are extremely interesting in many perspectives. The poorest countries are facing challenges where the alternative approaches and the alternative solutions are not all that many. We basically know what is needed to promote development in the lower-income countries. It's when countries reach up to lower-middle-income level that they begin to see choices going this way or that way. And these choices are related, for instance, to corporate culture. So I think that it would be really interesting to find tools and ways to leverage the private sector also in this group of countries, although they are not parts of the core of Swedish development cooperation. Global programs that also include these countries, I think, are very important. I'll stop here in the interest of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari. And you had some a sentence with very, small characters saying that you couldn't find an exhaustive list of statistics. And I think, if anything, this report, in addition to your recommendations, your funding, is that you've really done a groundbreaking work in looking into the statistics, and that is very helpful to, I hope, for both Swedfund, Sida, and all people and partners dealing with development cooperation in Sweden. Now, before inviting the commentators, maybe I should give you a little bit more about background of the EBA. And we do claim that we have a double independency. The committee itself is an independent committee, but the authors are also independent. It's their report. Of course, it's quality assured, etc., by the committee itself. And the committee also appoints a reference group, and some of the reference group's members are here today who also discuss with the authors work in progress, etc. And also you will, after this session, if you would like to interrelate more with the EBA, the secretariat is here, Emma, Jan, Urban, and Sonja. I saw Sonja somewhere also, who is head of the secretariat. So a number of people dealing with the EBA on a day-to-day basis. Maybe I didn't introduce myself. I'm Torgny Holmgren, I'm a member of the group.